Coming up.
My couch with my gun in my mouth, asking God to give me the courage to kill myself. On more than one occasion.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Man by the Gents Clinic. Six South African male medical doctors on a mission to change the way in which we perceive healthcare. Today we've got a very special guest, as we always do. It's the very amazing, the very talented Nick Engel. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, it's cool.
He is a trauma survivor, a previous alcohol dependency disorder, should we call it that, and now has transformed his life and the lives of many others through health fitness, particularly with regards to powerlifting. Powerlifting. Yeah. So, without further ado, let's give Nick a very big warm welcome.
Stop it, you guys. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's awesome to be here. Thank you for the opportunity. And thank you for what you guys have created in terms of a platform for saying what really does need to be said.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us, and we really appreciate your time. So I think all of us have read up a little bit about your journey, but in fragments, very small little bits and pieces. I think the most important thing that I'd like to know from you is the origin story.
Cool.
What got you into transforming your life? Do you think you would have made the decisions that you made to do the things that you did if you didn't go through what you went through?
Mm.
So maybe you can chat a little bit about your upbringing and what brought you to the place you find yourself in now.
100%. How long do I have?
Well, we've got 45 minutes.
But, all right, cool. I'll try and I'll be quick. So I have a little bit of an interesting origin story. I'm adopted. I was born 3 months premature. And what we suspect was, in some work I've done with therapists, is I know my mother was very young and unwed, my biological mother, and we suspect she tried to abort me, and I survived. So that, obviously, slightly different brain function to normal people, but that's also given me a different view on the world. My adopted mom, amazing person, very troubled, and the psychological help that she needed was not available at the time. So it was sort of like electroconvulsive shock therapy. I think she tried to take her own life also when she was very young. And unfortunately, she succeeded when she was 40 years old. I was 16. And she started using prescription medication and marijuana. And because of her choices, she put me in environments that were very challenging. So my stepfather, she remarried, and my stepfather took his own life. I was with him when I did that, when he did that. So it's even after sharing this for decades in recovery, it's very difficult to talk about. And after Errol killed himself, my mom kind of disappeared, came back after a couple of, could be weeks or months. I was 4 years old, so we moved to Cape Town, and my mom's drug use escalated. And she started to send me off for whatever reason. And it started with two of her gay male friends. My mom was gay. She was very creative. She was very arty. She had the most incredible view of the world. Like, taught us to go hunting, looking for fairies and stuff on mountain hikes. And every weekend we were out, you know, riding rapids on rivers or climbing mountains. So it was very, very cool, but she was in a lot of pain. And my sobriety's actually really helped me heal with my relationship with my mom. So sort of one night to being sent off to stay with two of her male gay friends, and these guys kept me for the night and they abused me. So they raped me, and I remember them being either unconscious or passing out or being asleep. And I managed to crawl out from under them, and I went to go and stand as far away from them as I could. The flat was locked, and I'm a 6-year-old little boy, And I was standing by the window in this apartment building in Sea Point, looking out at the Protea Hotel, the Ritz, the one with the revolving restaurant on top. And at the age of six, having just gone through what I went through, my thoughts weren't, I need to get help. I need to speak to my dad. So my adopted father was my best friend. Mm. We were chatting him about him earlier. Mm. He sadly passed away a few years ago. And he lived in Johannesburg. We lived in Cape Town. I lived in Cape Town with my mother. And the thoughts in my head was not, I need to speak to my dad. I need to speak to a teacher at school. I need to speak to a friend's parents. Mm. My thought that... What did I do that was so bad that would make my mom send me here? Mm-hmm. I immediately took on the guilt. Because my mom was perfect. We all want our parents to be perfect.
Exactly, yeah.
They can't make mistakes. What did I do that was so bad that would make me send her, that would make her send me here?
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the drug usage got worse. And she started to send me off to her dealers. And this was in the Cape Flats. And they would keep me. And I was a party trick. So there would be groups of guys. They would drug me. And the thing that's very hard for me to talk about, there's two things. The times I try to take my own life because I didn't understand what to do. But also the fact that I didn't ask for help and I went willingly to be raped. Because I thought in my mind as a six-year-old little boy that if I did a good enough job, and we can think about what that means, if I did a good enough job, then maybe I could get my mom to like me. Like I could make her proud of me.
Yeah.
They would tell her I was doing a good job. Mm-hmm. And then maybe I could get her to love me. Mm. After many years of therapy and work in recovery, and I've been sober for 18 years, I started to understand that I think my mother had very little idea as to what was going on. I really don't think she knew. Mm. I don't think she had an idea. Her drug use made her make decisions that she wouldn't make if she was sober. Mm-hmm. I made decisions. Anyone in recovery understands that. But the fact that I went to do whatever I could to get my mom's approval and to get her love.
Yeah.
And the other thing that is very challenging for me as well is the fact because they drugged me, where it was with cookies or stuff, then, and those are the things that I can remember, I got a little bit of time out of my head, out of reality of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that crossed over. I 9 years old at a family function when I had my first sip of wine. And I drank four cups. I started to steal the other kids' wine, put it in my pea soup. So at the age of nine, I was hiding the wine already. Yeah. So if people ask me, are you an alcoholic? It's like, yeah, I'm a professional. I'm a professional. And it's, you know, you were very kind with your language earlier on. But the reality is when I was drinking, I was a drunk.
Hmm.
When I choose to be sober, I can call myself an alcoholic. Because an alcoholic takes work every moment of every day. So that's a little bit of my background. And with that, unfortunately, I was on holiday with my dad and my mom took her own life. And we came to Johannesburg and I lived with my father, and the horror of losing my mom, the wonderful gift of getting to know my dad, because he had no idea what was going on. Nobody did. I didn't speak to anyone about this. And it was only when I got sober that I started to unpack this pain and this trauma. It took me 11 years of being sober to unpack the gang rapes. And that's working this program really hard. But that's what I love about sobriety. Every day that I was drinking, I was moving more towards hating myself, to loathing who I was. Every day in sobriety, no matter how tough, Santon traffic, every decision I couch with my gun in my mouth, asking God to give me the courage to kill myself. On more than one occasion. And when I talk about this, you know, if you stick a fork in your mouth and if you, so the older, sort of with the metal fillings and you get that taste, that's what I taste. And I taste the oil. And I believe I've got a good relationship with God. I believe my life is a gift. I understand it profoundly. And to be at that point of desperation,
really says a lot.
And unfortunately, I lost someone that I knew quite recently. And she, unfortunately, couldn't continue. And the thing that I try to explain to people, when you're in that situation, there is no logical thought. There is not a logical thought. There's nothing. There's just it's like being exhausted. If you guys worked like 72 hours, when you're doing, 72 hours, you're that tired, you'll do anything you can to get to sleep. That's really what it's like. It's not an anger towards people. It's not a resentment towards people. It's not a hatred towards yourself. You just have to stop because the drinking stops working. And the chaos that it creates just gets worse and worse and worse.
You've shared a lot with us, and I want to thank you, for being able to speak about something so sensitive and important in your life. And it's probably things, and you could tell us things that you probably want to forget. I don't know if it's
not a
that
thing.
That way you don't,
not a thing.
So that was going to be my question. Are those types of things that you perhaps want to forget, but I'm sure you'll work us through it, when you explain to us how you got through it. But you mentioned something that a lot of things caught me and I wanted to ask about, but I'll just ask just what you mentioned now about what you feel in that moment when you don't want to be anymore. You just repeat that for us, what it feels like and what is it that stops you from going through with it. And not you, I'm asking for people out there in general.
So in those moments, there's no rational thought. It's, I need a break from where I am. I need to stop. I just need to stop. I drank in order to numb myself. The drinking stopped working. So I suppose to put it, and that's why I love about sharing, and I do this because then I didn't get a choice in what happened to me as a child, but I can choose what I do with that pain and with that trauma. So in that moment, and I always learn about myself, which is the most wonderful gift. In those moments, it's just about stopping. It's just about stopping. Even if I, like, how crazy is this? If I could kill myself for an hour or for a week or for a month, then I would, suicide is a permanent problem. Suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And it's just having no other way in your world to stop what you're feeling and what you believe. Because what I've learned after that is not to trust what I think. And that's what you learn in recovery. That's why you have meetings, you have sponsors, you have counselors, so that in very early recovery, and I mean 5 to 10 years, you can hand over your thinking to other people that you trust. Because I didn't believe, I should not have believed what I was thinking. And I don't know why I didn't pull the trigger. I think maybe within me is I didn't want my father to find me because he did not deserve that.
Just another question from me. Thanks again. I think Dr. Matthew highlighted, the sensitivity of the what's going on and the fact that you're able to come here and share all of that, and share with all the men out there who follow our podcast.
And importantly, men, because we know that
100%.
There's a high incidence of men that commit suicide.
And we don't talk about it.
Yeah. And especially bringing the fact that, you know, raping, especially in male, is seen as taboo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to have someone, you know, explain how some of these things happen. Because sometimes we think, you know, people cause these things on themselves.
Mm.
You know, you forget that people at some stage were infants. You know, someone was a child at some stage trying to impress his parents. And yeah, yeah. But my question was, I just wanted to know, in terms of drug use, you did mention alcohol, by the way, is a drug.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm laughing because my mom was a drug addict, man. I'd never touch drugs. Drugs are evil. They're bad. They destroy lives. Can I have another beer, please? Exactly. That was genuine. That's the insanity of my logic.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And a lot of people are exactly in that boat who don't consider.
Yeah.
Well, alcohol, I mean, is sold on national TV with everyone watching, you know. So, yeah, but my question is, you know, did you ever dabble on different drugs?
I smoked dope in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. Not my thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I remember chatting to guys in the bar that were doing cocaine. And sorry, how much for a gram? What? How long does that last you? What? Like, this is how old I am. I was paying 40 Rand for 2 liters of beer, for a pitcher of beer. So for me, like, I had to maximize my Rand value for alcohol effect. And I'm serious. That was my logic. Like, that's what I drank because I worked out. Whiskey didn't give me what I needed. So I didn't do drugs because they were too expensive. And I'm an alcoholic. Like, I genuinely believe in my experience, what I've learned, that there is a difference between alcoholics and addicts, but alcoholics are addicts. And I'm very, very, very grateful to be an alcoholic and not an addict. So a drug for a drug addict.
Just explain the
because
the,
for the all I have to – I stop drinking. That's all I got to deal with. For an addict, they then have to stop using their chosen drug or drugs, and then have to develop that relationship with not drinking. So it's very, very hard. It's much harder for them.
They're doing both. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, correct. So you just cross-addict to something else. I cross-addicted. I spent my last 15,000 Rand on a credit card to go to a rehab center here in 12 Gayra Road called First Step, and that's now part of Houghton House.
Yeah.
And I – like, literally, I could go on a work trip or pay for rehab. So I went into rehab because I didn't want it. That was the reason I got called into a meeting at work. I worked for a firm called Hereford Financial Service, insurance guys. So like you can understand that lifestyle as well with the parties and the drinking and everything that was going on. And my boss, my MD and my CEO, Michael and Glenn, called me in one day. Now, you saw the picture. That's what I looked like. I stank like the back of a bottle store. You know the back of a bottle with store bar fridge? That, yeah, with the exact, like, it smells like pee, right? Yeah, there we go. That's the guy. Look at him. All right, that's before fat apps, please. Okay.
Yeah.
And they said to me, Nick, do you have a drinking problem? And that saved my life because I knew in that moment, if I said no, I most likely would have been fired. Because they weren't asking me if I had a drinking problem. They were asking me if I needed help. And did I feel I was worthy of saving? So I said yes. And then they said to me, do you want help? I said yes. That was a Thursday. The next morning I was sitting in front of Dan Wolf, the most terrifying. And Dan's a sweet guy. The most terrifying experience of my life. And at the end of that hour, Dan said to me, Nick, you're an alcoholic. You start the program on Monday. Best news I ever heard. Because I understood, great, I'm an alcoholic. There's a path. If they didn't ask me if I had a drinking problem and they just let me go, I would not have lived another 6 months. I would have drunk myself to death. I would have driven into something at high speed, or I would have shot myself. And the reason I can share the stuff that's challenging and difficult, but I've been doing it for over 18 years. And here's two things. Firstly, the number of times that I've shared at a rehab, every time that I've shared, So thousands of times. Every time I've shared, guys have come up to me and shared that they've been abused. So talking about this abuse has cost me with certain relationships where people don't want me to talk about it. But when I stand in front of someone that's having a breakthrough in a rehab center, sharing stuff that they've never been able to talk about before, I can't not do this.
Yeah.
I can't be that selfish. It's because people spoke up in recovery, in treatment that had a year, 2 years, 10 years, 30 years. When I had a week and they shared their pain, I have to share my pain. It's my responsibility. The other thing is talking about suicide. How many people come up to me afterwards or openly share that they also have tried to kill themselves? What you guys are doing is so important because the struggle out there is so real. And the only thing, sure, this is a hard thing to say, but I'm saying it as someone who's lived it. The only thing worse than killing yourself is living a life wanting or needing to or believing that you have to kill yourself. So where I was living that life, coming to these stages of sitting with my gun in my mouth every couple of months or every couple of years, not being able to go on, no one deserves to live like that. And no one deserves to take their own life, because I've never met a single person in recovery that was not super intelligent, very funny, incredibly empathetic, hyper empaths, feeling everything. That's why, and just the world deserves everybody that's here.
Can I ask, I mean, you touched on what's worse than killing yourself is living a life where you basically feel like it has no value, or that you desire to end your life, or desire to not be here anymore. And we have discussed this on other podcasts before, and I think a lot of people say that they feel this feeling of hopelessness and helpless, and that their life has no meaning. Would you say that for you, was it the alcohol specifically, when you were able to cut that out, did that make you feel like you had achieved something and now you had this breakthrough that now you can continue your life? It doesn't need to end because you've overcome this great struggle. Or was that just the start of still many, many more struggles that you still had to overcome? And what were those?
Sure. I get this sometimes on my podcast. Great question. Really. So I think to say this, alcohol has nothing to do with my quality of life right now. Stopping drinking is easy. Learning to live without drinking is nearly impossible. And what I mean by that is, and I will not drink, I don't touch alcohol, because I understand what the consequences are. And people say to me, can't you have one? I said, well, if I right now I'm sober, I'm thinking as a sober person. If I have one, I'm thinking as someone under the influence of alcohol. So also, like, I'm not willing to give away my willpower and my safety. So the alcohol didn't have an effect on my quality of life. What I learned in recovery had an effect. And the biggest thing that I've learned is service. So, you know, I have anxiety. I desperately need to be liked. Hello. I went to be raped because I wanted my mom to like me. That's what I learned. I am. I'm a thing for other people to use for their pleasure. So they asked for volunteers to wash coffee cups. And my first meeting. So the meeting's over now. A sink full of 26 mugs with saliva. And I have issues even today with bodily fluids from other people. Just that's – now I have to go and wash this. No one else volunteered. No one else wanted to do it. So I had to put my hands into that water with all these other people's bodily fluids and my anxiety and everything. And it was my heart is racing, and I did it. And that was the achievement, not the stopping drinking. And my understanding that doing things for people, for others, without the expectation of anything back, but primarily without any self-sacrifice, where I end up hurt.
Mm.
So I started a development academy where we train and develop young coaches and athletes from disadvantaged communities. Mm. All of my coaches, all of my streaming team are from challenging backgrounds. Mainly, a lot of the guys are from Queens High School. The guys got scholarships to go to Parktown to play rugby. They become awesome coaches. Mm. That is how I build worth in my life. Mm. So what I realized is, for me, feeling as bad, I was very insular and very isolated and very selfish.
Yeah.
I was giving myself all my attention because I needed it through service and like driving up to Richmond and up into the mountains of rural Natal, you know, to go and do a talk to 60 kids through a translator. And when I talk about abuse and I see the faces change on some of the kids because, yeah, that is the most heartbreaking thing I have to do. Because when I see that they know and I know that they know. But then they look at it and they go, an umlungu, a white man, a rich, you know, because like you're rich because, you know, you came in a car. Because these are kids with no shoes, like really rural. And they're going, and that's the message I get across to them. It's not you. The way that people treat us, the way that they deal with us, has got nothing to do with us.
I think as South Africans, we probably are not aware or don't realize how common this type of thing is. Child abuse, sexual child abuse, child molestation is. I heard someone tell me that they were sexually molested for the first time when I was 24. It was another student who was telling us. Maybe it's not publicized, it's not in the news, people don't speak about it, maybe enough. People, victims, don't perhaps speak about it, and they're just out there in society. Some use drugs, some are alcoholics, some abuse women, some do different or deviant, go into deviant sexual practices or taboos or whatever it is, and we don't understand their behavior and we call them all sorts of names and so forth.
Some end up homeless on the street.
Some are homeless on the street. And it all stems from there. That was the root cause of it all. But we'll never know. In the past 18 years, have you come to understand how common this type of problem is in South Africa?
Is it? I've never spoken at a rehab center, at a school, at a university, at a corporate, and not have people come up to me to talk to me about this having happened to them. I've encountered thousands of people, and those were the ones who had the courage to come and talk to me. I don't want to throw out statistics, but I would say it's more than 50% to some extent for men.
For men being
men.
As boys, they were abused.
Molested.
Yeah. You know,
that's actually scary.
Because
obviously just your anecdotal from what you've experienced.
Correct. Because if you look at the percentage of people that are abusing drugs and alcohol that end up in treatment, and then that would end up within me at that moment that come and talk to me. It hasn't been a talk where that hasn't happened. You know, and this is what I'd like to share, that I believed very strongly that when you abuse a child, you murder who that child was going to be. I believe that completely, and I lived that. But 11, 12, 13 years into recovery, I found who I was again. I found that child. So we can find who we are. We can be who we were always meant to be. But you do. And if someone doesn't get help, doesn't get treatment, doesn't get into a program, doesn't get involved in service, that in a way that where they're not self-sacrificing, that person who they were going to be stays murdered.
When you say in a way that's not self-sacrificing, what exactly do you mean? So I understand in the example you gave about yourself, it was you who had to overcome that fear and wash those cups because that took a lot of courage out of you. But what other acts of service would be, you know, not self-sacrificing?
So imagine where you volunteer at a baby home and there's an outbreak maybe of TB. So speaking of like some of the clinics that are in Hillbrow in the city, and the head of the home says, don't come. You know, you're coming to play with the kids and the babies and the toddlers. Don't come today because there's an incidence of TB or something else. Say, no, I'm going. So where you put your safety on the back foot because you need that affirmation. So it's about, and again, so now it's about you, not them. Or, you know, you're donating money where then you struggle, or you're giving so much time that you can't perform financially at your job. So where it's detrimental to your well-being, physically, emotionally, financially, then you need to unpack that. And that's, again, why we need to have sponsors. We need to have a service position. We need to have someone that we can talk to and that we can trust.
Yeah.
And multiple people that we can go to and talk to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So does that sort of answer the question?
Yeah, I think that does.
Yeah, so do service, but don't hurt yourself in the process.
And this specifically when you're talking about people who have suffered abuse.
Yeah.
Because they innately, by their nature, become people pleasers or...
Absolutely. Right, like I didn't remember the abuse until I was I'd been drinking at the Keg and Beagle, and I was sitting, came home, I was drunk, and I was watching a carte blanche, and a guy was talking about abuse, and the memories of the abuse of the two guys just flooded back. I collapsed. And I phoned my therapist, and I told her. She said, come straight over. Most amazing woman. And it was in my 20s, late 20s. So maybe even early 30s. I stopped drinking when I drank from 9 until 36.
Sure.
That's a long time. And you said you've been sober for about 18 years.
Yeah.
I mean, you keep on talking about all these initiatives that you do, you know, reach out to the kids. And can you just run us through, you know, your own programs that you run or your organization?
So I sold insurance when I was drinking. When I got sober, I moved to Cape Town with the firm. I thought that'll be what I need. And I realized it's same stuff, just a different environment.
Yeah.
And I got wiped out financially in Cape Town. I lost everything. I went from a great practice in Joburg to, for 8 months, I didn't have an income. And I ended up renting a room in a house, and I was living on bread rolls from Checkers because I didn't have money to eat. Now, I'd been sober for 3 years already at this time. I developed shingles. My nervous system collapsed, like 8 months of intense pressure.
Yeah.
A dear friend of mine, Ian Levitt, lent me 2,000 rand. He said, get your ass back. He lent me money to go and pay for medication for the ARVs, for the shingles. And I had friends of mine bringing me food to eat. I didn't have money for food. I was saving my money to get to work and back.
Yeah.
Like, it was that dire. And
what work were you doing at that time?
Insurance. Still selling insurance, yeah. I could not operate in the Cape Town market. I can't operate in the Cape Town market. Not for me. Joburg's where I like to, you know,
okay, you don't
much
want
easier.
To go back to Cape Town.
No. Yeah. What I realized, living in Joburg affords you the opportunity to visit wherever you want.
Yeah.
Cape Town, you're stuck there, kind of thing.
This is where work is done.
This is where work
is done. It's a holiday destination.
It's lovely. And now it's insane. Cape Town's for foreigners. I like to go and hang out in the Marnus. Reasonable hotel rates, reasonable food, good people. So Cape Town's special, but yeah. And so Ian gave me 2,000 rand. That's all the money I had. Got in my car, packed my car with my entire life was in my car. And I left Cape Town at 3 p.m. And I'd booked into the Formula One in Beaufort. And driving into Lanesburg, I thought, what happens if something goes wrong with a car, if I don't have fuel? It's like 2,000 rand. I'm isolated on the strip. I didn't phone my dad. I didn't tell him what was going on because I'd already put him through so much stress. I didn't want to put him through more pressure. I slept in my car at the petrol station at Lanesburg. I cancelled the hotel room. And like that sounds quite terrifying where you're so broke you have to borrow money and you have to sleep in your car in a petrol station. But I woke up at 4 o'clock and I got to drive into the Karoo when it was pitch black, pull my car over and look up at the most incredible night sky or morning sky and watch the sunrise in the Karoo. So it's our attitude determines everything. So I came back to Joburg. I worked for a company called Dabit Telecoms. It was a startup in the inner city of Joburg, building networks. I got to work in Joburg, in Berea, in Hillbrow, in the inner city, coming into the city at like 4 PM, the Shizanyamas, the Bries are going, the kids are playing soccer, basketball, go hang out there, sell. We built a data network and a telephone network, go and sell airtime, do sales. It was the most epic year ever. That contract came to an end, and I started my gym. And I started with a friend of mine, Shira, and then she got her sisters and her friends involved. We started to grow like that. I started to build up and do corporates. So we brought in some very large corporates that we still have most of them that we train. And I said, right now, I had friends of mine coming and training with me, and they brought friends and they brought friends. So one of the guys that was introduced to me was a rugby coach at Queen's High School. Okay. So he said, Nick, one day, can you come and do some workshops with some of my rugby boys? Absolutely.
Eastern Cape?
Queens, Bears Valley. Bertrand's.
Oh, okay.
So, like, thinking of this thunderstorm, I don't know if you guys saw how it was raining now.
Yeah.
So just keep that in mind. And we went on, so went to go and train the guys. I say train, they say torture. You know, it's rugby boys, it's conditioning. The most amazing kids. And I saw this incredible work ethic that they had. At the time, I was training at a school in the north with powerlifting, with a powerlifting coach there. Private school had everything, the best facilities, the best coaching, and amazing kids, like really amazing kids. But Queens had very little in terms of available resources. The school was spotless. It was well run. There was respect for the teachers, but there were challenges. And I saw these kids with this. So they're like, please, can you come again? Came back. Can we come and train with you, coach? Said, guys, sure, we set times. They walked from Bears Valley to Glen Hazel, where my gym was at the time. One day, I'm driving in a thunderstorm like this, a monstrous thunderstorm. So at that time, I'm doing the corporates, I'm doing the private clients, working from 3:30 in the morning when I'd get up, because I'd open the gym at 4:30, through to 9:10 at night. I was young, I had the energy, and it was fun. Now, so driving back to the gym, there's this massive thunderstorm. I thought, sure, no way these oaks are coming. They've turned back. The only intelligent thing to do. And I got to the gym, and they were sitting there sopping wet. They had put on their training clothes. They hung up their uniforms. And I thought, okay, there's something going on here that I'm missing, that I need to see. That was one thing that hit me. Another thing that hit me was I spoke to one of my coaches, my first coach, Chris Lau, fantastic bodybuilder. He's got his own training facility now. He's training guys. He's doing really well, very much into the bodybuilding scene and monster deadlift and really a lovely guy. And I said to Chris, dude, you can't come and train in slip slops. He said to me, coach, my only other shoes are my school shoes. And that he was in standard 8 at the time. He said, they have to last me to matric. So these are guys that didn't know if there was food when they got home. So I'm looking at this effort and the fact walking in a thunderstorm, coming in slip slops, you know, with that in, that drive and understanding that this is an opportunity to perform better in rugby and get a scholarship and do something for themselves and for their family.
Yeah.
So that when I made the decision, I started the academy. We started training coaches. We started giving them a little bit of a stipend to help them. We started to train rugby players. A couple of our guys went to Parktown. A couple got bursaries to UJ. But just because you're at university, they didn't have money for food. So give them a little bit of money for food. And some of them, they've done really well. So that sort of showed me. And then with that, we started to go out and work with – there's a wonderful foundation run by a lady, Hazel, in Natal called the Butterfly Foundation, Hazel Hoskins. They do incredible work. Incredible. It's like we got in touch. I don't know how, maybe social media, or someone put me in touch with her. We'd go down to Natal and do workshops. So now I'm taking my – then we'd go to take them to Umhlanga. Like, my guys got buff. They all got – like, they're looking good.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, walking on the beach in the mall with them, they're getting a lot of attention. It was lovely to see. And then, like, we'd do workshops in Alex. One of my favorite photos, I'll send it to Sina, is Chris doing a double bicep flex. And these kids standing like this, big eyes. And the one kid feeling it and turning to his mate going, that's a positive male role model. Mm. My head coach, Cap, he's also – Canius has gone on his own now. He started his own thing, trains guys in Santon. Yeah. We got guys competing in powerlifting and, like, winning gold at international level, coaching at international level. My stream team, we've sent them overseas, sent them to Algeria last year. Hopefully we can get them to Tunisia this year. I've traveled enough. They must go and have fun.
Just to catch you there. Yeah. I mean, you just said you traveled a lot.
Yeah.
I think you didn't give us any details about your background in powerlifting.
Oh, me?
Coaching,
you know?
Yeah. Sorry. We hear how
it's not
how
about me. I'm getting as excited.
No, today is definitely about you.
Okay. So I was involved in martial arts when I was younger because I wanted to get so brutally powerful. And we run a lot of self-defense workshops as well. Mm. Like, I remember during the xenophobic attacks, going into the inner city to do workshops with church groups to train people, and having a guy come up to me in Santon City and burst into tears because he was so grateful that someone took the time to come to them and help. Like, this is the stuff I get to do. It's epic. Okay, so started powerlifting by default because I wanted to learn Olympic lifting, but I'm dyslexic. So I went to a powerlifting coach, Rodney Anthony, is a legend. And training with Rod, started competing.
Yeah.
And in 2016, went to Morocco, a town called Meknes, competed for South Africa, won gold for SA. So I got my gold medal for my country. It's a very cool thing to have a gold medal around your neck and your country's flag over your shoulders. It was very cool. We took one flag, though. We had to share it. But that was very cool. I made a decision, though, when I won, I would stop competing and focus on coaching. So coached athletes. I've coached at international level. I'm an international referee category 2.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone overseas and commentated. And if you guys notice, I enjoy speaking, and which is cool.
You want to see
a dyslexic guy reading names of Asian, African, and Pacific lifters? But I'll explain to them, guys, this is how I do it. I'm sorry, and they all come and spend time with me, trying to help realize it's a lost cause. And then they just know when I call them, they know. They know. Yeah, that's it. And the Kazakhstan guys are laughing at me too much. So did that, and then last year started competing again, got bullied into it, and got the opportunity to qualify at nationals to represent South Africa twice last year, won silver in the Asia-Pacific Africa Champs, and in the Africa Champs, which is all of the Africa countries, won gold.
Those two were in the bench press.
Yeah. Saturday's South Africa Champs for bench. I'm competing. They're letting me lift with the ladies because we're doing a book launch for an amazing woman and which business team leadership book. Unbelievable. Marichen Mortimer. So I can't wait. That's going to be fun. So I've got to go lift, shower, hopefully. Put on a suit and go and interview her because I'm running the interview. It's like, that's the fun stuff.
Yeah.
But like standing on a podium with a gold medal and hearing your national anthem is something very, very, very special.
Yeah.
But it's nowhere near as special as like seeing my coaches achieve something or our stream team do something or a kid lift a weight that they believed they couldn't.
Yeah.
Like that's really, really cool. You know,
so what do you think I can bench press? You said a very absurd number.
Well, funny you should mention. So you said, I'm just looking at you, I'm going to say 165. Because 30 to 40 kilos for you, it would be technique. It's just about getting the technique right. And bench is the most technical lift.
Mm-hmm.
So 165 for a touch and go rep. So start down to your chest, hold it there, press, up, lock
so
it up.
Does it
rack.
Bounce in your chest?
No,
or?
No. You hold it down okay. under control for a second, and I'm so keeping that tension in bringing it down so you can hold it is what helps you get it up. So that's
easy, right,
like for me.
Because if you let go of the tension it, yeah. then you can't really push back.
So like I 100%. I had 2 weeks to train for nationals. So I just worked up to doing 250 kilo negatives. Yes. So I just lower it under control. So like 185, 200, 250, up to 250 under control. And then the guys would help me lift it up.
Yeah.
Mm. So, and that, because the negative is where the strength is built.
So you've got 165.
165, easy peasy. We'll get you in the gym.
I don't want any pec.
No, there'll be no pec test. Huh? Yeah. And you can do it in Crocs.
Yeah, perfect. Shoe. It's my favorite shoe. Yeah.
Yeah. No, the best shoe in the world. You need to wash the blood off from the ear.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
Or you wear Crocs. So yeah, but it's just like, and if I could share one thing, the difficulty, the pain, the trauma. First off, you believe you're alone in your pain and your suffering. You're not. So what I love is going and sharing at meetings and talking to people. Mm. And I can tell them exactly what's going on inside of their heads. Mm. And they think I'm somehow magical. It's not, because it's going on inside of my head.
Yeah.
Mm. That's how we all relate to trauma and pain the same way. Mm. We all have that self-loathing. And it doesn't matter what we put out there until we can start to work on it and until we can start to fix ourselves and heal. Yeah. So there's nothing that is so bad out there that you don't deserve to be here.
Strong.
That's the title of this episode. I love that.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
And
strong word.
And sure. Wanting to kill yourself is not a weakness of character. Needing to kill yourself is not a weakness of character. It's just a lack of understanding about the alternatives. I didn't know a way out of my drinking until I was shown a way. I didn't believe there was a way out. I tried for decades until I could find another way, because alcohol is a tool. Drugs are a tool. Food, sex, gambling, social media, whatever it is, it's a tool to change how we're feeling. But all that tool does is deprive us of developing the skills we need to live life without it.
Yeah. Yeah.
My drinking didn't make me better in social situations. It robbed me of developing social skills. Yeah. It didn't make me better at dealing with my anxiety. It robbed me of that. Yeah. Now, when I fly, like, I'm dyslexic. If there's turbulence, I get terrified. I have to fly often. By the way, I'm just putting that out there. Yeah. For people watching, it's going, you're always traveling. Nick.
Yeah.
But like, I read when it's going through bumps, and I have to work so hard to read, I forget about the turbulence.
Yeah.
So these are the skills, because in an area where I was uncomfortable, if I got invited to a wedding in early recovery, I would say to the bride and groom, I love you guys, thank you for asking me, but if I get uncomfortable, I'm going to have to leave. Yeah. Would you like to invite someone else, or are you comfortable to have me come? And they all said, please, we'll invite other people. No, I'm kidding.
She's invite other people.
No. So, you know, come. And you can, because I knew that if I wasn't happy, I'd leave. Flying in an aeroplane was the most terrifying thing for me, because they don't want you to leave at 40,000 feet or whatever it is. So I had to find another way. Now, as a lighthearted example as that is, there is another way. Just because we don't know it and we don't believe it, and we believe with every ounce of our being, every ounce of our being, that it's not there, it's there. We cannot understand stuff we can't imagine, and there's always a way out.
Thank you so much, Nick. I think we've all learned a lot. I think it was very emotional to hear you talking about
this. Very educational,
yeah.
Eye-opening.
Yeah, eye-opening. I think for all of us, as men, we've gone through struggles in our life. I can't say anything near what you've gone through. I can't imagine the type of trauma and pain that you had to experience at such a young age. But I think the lesson that we can all learn is through those difficulties, it just takes courage to overcome and a little bit of faith that we can.
And just in closing, you know, we did chat off podcast about the fact that we also run an online clinic and we treat some of these types of issues pertaining to substance abuse, pertaining to and how it affects, you know, our sexual health, all of that. We know that alcohol use and its dependence has major effects on one's testosterone levels, on cortisol levels, spikes cortisol levels, worsens your sleep, and then you know, can cause a lot of the issues that we do treat. So please reach out to us at jensclinic.co.za, even if you want just to chat to one of us and get some help. Thank you once again.
Thank you. Can I add just something to that quickly? This is important. I'll be super quick. One, I'm nothing special. I'm not stronger than anyone at all. So I'm not uniquely gifted. Anyone can do this. And two, lastly, to follow up on what you said, sometimes what you're thinking and feeling is chemical.
Mm.
So you can't trust it. That's why people need to get in touch with you guys. Just make sure, go for your bloods. Just make sure that everything's right.
Everything's fine.
And if it's not right, fix it. We're hormonal machines. But our hormones run our brain.
100%. 100%. So if you're looking for TRT, comes to jensclinic.co.za. Thank you once again, Nick Engel. Please check him out on social media and join one of his initiatives if you're interested in helping out. That's it from us. Another episode of Let's Talk Man with the Gents Clinic. My name is Dr. Swail Essa, signing off.
Dr. Brendan Matthews.
Dr. Nhlanhla Vilakazi.
Not a Dr. Nick.
We'll see you guys next week. Cheers.